And here we are with this week's edition of The Boundless Show with the team in the studio, Steve, Mott, Candace, and myself. Hello, everyone.
Lisa.
We are fresh off of a very late night. I know I was here at Focus on the Family, up in our public policy department, helping with live coverage of the election. And we're going to discuss the election this morning. I think I finally made it to bed at about 1 or 2 a.m. I can't remember quite which, but really.
I stayed up late, yeah.
Yeah.
Man, what is our problem? What were we in bed at 9:30?
Well, I was responsible for writing up results of a bunch of the House races, so it was kind of fascinating to follow all those and make sure I had my ducks in the row and actually knew what House races I was following. After having voted earlier in the day, and that was fascinating as well. Did any of you guys vote with the touchscreen?
Yes, I did.
I did the touchscreen as well, and it's all these folks that are kind of like over 80 that are running the polls, you know. Bless their hearts, they're awesome. I love them, and they often have snacks. However, I went in, and no one there knew how to show me how to use the touchscreen. So one of the guys finally was like, you know what, Bill is out having a cigarette. As soon as he comes in, he'll be able to show you.
It's self-explanatory.
I think it was pretty self-explanatory, but he had to give me the card, you know.
Oh,
so,
you need the card.
So anyway, good times in Colorado. It was a huge ballot. It was like, you know, you had to sit down.
It was. 13 pages.
Yeah, they're going to put one of those in the Library of Congress, I think, after it's done. But anyway, so we are now on the morning after.
Wasn't that a show?
Yeah, maybe. And how are you all feeling?
I feel great, Lisa. Thanks for asking.
Feels great. All right. Tell us why you feel great.
I don't know. I just love elections. It didn't go exactly the way I voted. But my hope isn't in elections or politics. My hope is in the Lord. And I'm excited about the good things that happened last night. The reason I stayed up late was to follow the Senate races in Georgia, Minnesota, and Oregon, and Alaska to see if the Republicans were going to win so that we could have... we mean in America, could have a filibuster Senate, a filibuster possible Senate. What do you call that?
Just to have some checks and
a
balances.
Filibuster-proof.
To have some restraint.
Did Alaska Senator win?
Yeah, that convict. I mean, no, he's not a convict.
Felon.
He's a felon. He's a convicted felon. Yes. He did win, I think 99% of the votes in, and I think he's ahead 6,000.
We Americans may need a new lineup of leaders. I'm not sure convicted felons are the best face.
But they were voting for the future ex-senator of Alaska.
And actually it'll be easier probably to have a runoff victory that retains that seat.
Yeah. Oh, no. Well, it's not going to be a...
They'll have
the governor
a special
would
election.
If he ends up leaving the seat, the governor, who made some headlines this year herself.
Right. She may appoint a good person.
Appointing a governor.
Well, did it on the early side of the night? I mean, we all saw that it went to Obama pretty quickly. Did you all expect that, or kind of what were you expecting to happen maybe that did or didn't pan
really
out that way?
I was bummed that it wasn't a longer... I was expecting to be able to put the kids to bed and then... brew a pot of coffee and get out the map that the paper had printed and start keeping track of votes. And you know, that would be a bit more of a horse race and it would be more interesting to watch. And I was still hopeful that there would be an upset.
Yeah.
Well, you know, too, I know most of the papers and, you know, that the headlines today have been focusing on the fact that this is a very historic election. You know, everybody's pointing out how incredible it is that America's moved beyond our slave past and racism to be able to elect an African-American president. And I think a lot of us recognize just how historic that is, but also stop and think, boy, sure would have been nice if we had broke that barrier with some of the many African-Americans who also happen to be very strongly pro-life and a lot more outspoken on religious liberties and other things we care about.
Yeah.
And so I know that's something that there is a lot of excitement today about the historical nature and think, wow, that's amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I guess we can support that too.
It's a little bit of a letdown though to feel like you can't really enjoy the joy of that and relish the victory of that and think about the many, many Christian blacks in America who sacrificed so much to pave the way for this, and then to realize that the policies that the president-elect supports, many of them, the abortion one being the most obvious, if you have read any of Margaret Sanger's works, are really built on the notion that we need to destroy African Americans. I mean, it's a tragedy in a way.
I think you can do both.
Yeah,
I do. It occurred to me last night when they called the election for Obama, my neighbors who are black, we just heard them honking their horns and celebrating. And it just, we should celebrate that, because 40 years ago, with this country had institutionalized racism. And in just 40 years, we have a black president. I mean, that is something to celebrate.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think it was frustrating during the race at times that for people who did disagree on serious policy issues, for anybody to even question, you know, to think that maybe there's a race issue there, and couldn't believe that you could actually just disagree on policies. Because I think, you know, we do have some incredibly well-spoken, well-thought-out candidates that we probably are going to see both parties having more breakthroughs. And obviously, you know, people shouldn't overlook the breakthrough appointments that George W. Bush had, you know, to have our first black Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense. And we're, you know, we're going to see those party-wide.
Yeah. Well, I do wonder if there's a double standard in race and politics in America. I wonder what would have happened if a black conservative had won the presidency. Would there be this celebration?
Well, and what if, you know, the Republicans had won and you would have had your first female vice president? How muted would that celebration have been? Because there were plenty of people saying on the other side, she's not a real woman because she doesn't toe the party line on pro-choice issues or whatever else. So that's the frustrating thing, is that when you do have historic breakthroughs, you've got all this baggage that it's hard to fully celebrate it, because you got all the ideology mixed into it.
Well, I feel like I've just been given a good prayer for the new president for the next 4 years. And that is that he would be a good steward of this historic opportunity. And that even if right this minute today, he's not yet ready to defend the unborn or stand up for the sanctity of marriage, that as he takes on the weight of governing, that he would become aware of this opportunity to steward the opportunity he's been given.
Yeah, that prayer is so important. I know there are probably some of our listeners who did vote for Obama and are, you know, maybe thinking like maybe some of us have thought after past elections, okay, we're done now and we can skate until the next election. And the reality is, whether you agree with him or disagree with him, you've got a responsibility, biblical responsibility, to pray for all those in authority that that we would be able to live peaceable lives. And so I though want to speak to the person who's listening, who is a young Christian conservative who maybe was blown away by just how many of their friends just ran off in another direction, and they feel like they're in this conservative Christian wilderness now, thinking, am I the last pro-life supporter out here? Am I the last person who cares about religious liberties and other things? To realize just how cyclical these things are. I mean, in fact, I was just realizing I'm the only person in the studio, including our producer, who hasn't lived in Washington, D.C. I mean, haven't you guys seen these cycles and recognized, you know, how things come and go?
That's right. Yeah. I mean, when you compare it to 96, 92, 76, 64, and the Democratic takeovers in those years, it's not surprising that this happened. Bill Clinton actually won by a greater margin in 96. I think it was 8.5%. And in 92, he had a greater majority in the Congress than Obama has now. So yeah, they may be more liberal, but these things are cyclical, especially if Obama overreaches like Bill Clinton did in 92, like Carter did in 76, and like Johnson did in 64. I think it's going to be a pretty quick cycle.
Let's talk about another thing historic that happened, and that is three marriage initiatives passing last night, especially the one in California, where hundreds of millions of dollars were poured into that initiative to fight it, basically the ban on gay marriage there. You know, you have Steven Spielberg writing checks, you have huge lobbies writing checks, and all of that money, or much of that money, I should say, was met by individual donors. I mean, at the grassroots level, people who care about this issue who don't have the capacity to write that kind of, you know, write that kind of check. And those initiatives still passed. I mean, you think of California alone. Think of how many people there checked a box for Obama and Biden and also checked a box for marriage. Yeah. And it just shows how on some of the issues, people still, their hearts are still resonating with what we feel is true and biblical and important.
Yeah, marriage is still important in blue states.
What is true?
Yeah. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, those votes were encouraging, and not just California, but Florida. Florida had to get 60% of the vote, and they got 62. Mm-hmm. Arizona, that reversed their previous decision on marriage. So
it crosses party lines, it crosses ethnic lines, gender lines, and I think it should be a wake-up call for people who are saying we've got a mandate for radical cultural change to say in a sweeping election that did bring in a candidate talking about major change, that this was one key area where people were very clear that they do not want to see sweeping change.
Well, and let's be clear too, the president-elect did not campaign as a left of center liberal. I mean, he did not run on the issues that we're starting to worry he may govern on. He ran as a moderate.
That's right, he did. And the result of this election doesn't mean that we're not a right to center nation anymore. I mean, it's possible, but Obama ran on cutting taxes. He ran on a strong defense message and killing bin Laden and going into Pakistan to do it.
A strong pro-family, you know, dad should stay and marry the moms and should be
and
responsible for
put down the video
games
and get involved in their education.
Yeah, I mean, it's like a Bill Cosby message. I mean,
keep your health care, not universal health care, but you can keep your health care.
He sounded a lot like Bill Clinton triangulating, you know, to get these positions that were moderated.
And I don't know if I believe it, but he actually said a couple of times on the stump or in interviews that he wanted to reduce abortion.
Too, there was the whole issue of I think people had lost their stomach for the wars, especially for the season of time where wars weren't being prosecuted well, and we were seeing all this loss of life and wondering what we were getting for it. And too, there was a reaction to economy that was being stewarded by Republican leadership who could have done some things better.
Well, wait,
to a degree. I mean, you have to think about it. This is a very fiscally undisciplined Republican administration.
Well, that's
that
true.
Spent a lot of money, and there were indications that when they saw there was more crisis, they just did an economic stimulus bill when there were probably other things that needed attention more.
Yeah. Right. That's not to say the Democrat majority in the Congress had nothing to do with it. They were squarely
and there's
in
a
charge
reason
of the process.
There's a reason that the Congress was more unpopular than the president.
Yeah.
And so this was kind of a sweeping response to, okay, status quo isn't working. Let's get some fresh blood in there.
This was a throw-the-bums-out election, and it was primarily for economic reasons, but also the war, too.
Well, you know, something we should be very clear about here. I mean, obviously, we're demonstrating a certain favoring of one party over another, but I think the reality is we have our disappointments with a Republican Party that's demonstrated some difficulty in being able to govern well.
That's right.
We find ourselves attracted in our lifetime to the Republican Party because the Republican Party seems to court us best on issues we care about regarding life, religious liberty, an approach to culture that gives us the freedom.
Limited
government.
Yeah, and I would say the Republican Party platform does that. Lately, we haven't had very many actual Republican leaders who do that.
Well, and so to that end, I think our bigger issue is we are talking to Christians, realizing we're not beholden to one party or another, and who knows what changes lie ahead of us. I mean, there's already speculation. I mean, is the Republican Party going to reinvent itself by jettisoning its social conservative wing? Is that what lost them an election? And that kind of thing happens all the time. I think the bigger question is, where are we as Christians who are citizens of America and are trying to stay influential, trying to stay plugged in as, you know, as a body of believers within our political process?
Well, we still have that responsibility in the city of man as Christians to engage their culture, to defend our neighbor by helping those who can't speak for themselves, like the unborn. We shouldn't give up. We should fight on and be encouraged that we live in a country where we have representative government, where we have another election cycle in 2 years.
Yeah.
Well, and I think that is why Prop 8 is such a great example, because we had, you know, at Focus on the Family, we had over 7,000 pastors that rallied their congregations, that went door to door, many of them, to turn out that vote, like I said, on a very small grassroots scale. And we had Dr. Dobson himself was at a rally in San Diego just, I think, last week, where 30,000 people showed up and prayed from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. in a football stadium, just crying out to God for that decision. And many of those pastors had said that they'd been in a 40-day fast, you know, just for that issue and not wanting to come up short and wanting to make sure that they were really seeking God in that. And I think if we could multiply that, you know, on a national scale and really start rallying Christians nationwide and worldwide on behalf of things that are important to us and recognizing, you know, God's hand in it, I think we always feel like, can we still make a difference, you know? And it's so true that we can, knowing obviously that God is sovereign in the midst of that, but he listens to his people.
The picture of the funeral is in a mind. 7 days since the day her father died. At 17, her faith is shaken to the core. She's losing hopes that it used to be worth fighting.
This is Steve Waters, and I'm stepping in for Lisa for today's culture segment. And what we wanted to do is bring in a special guest here right on the Focus on the Family campus, Dr. Chris Leland, who is the Executive Director of College Student Ministries at Focus on the Family. But Chris also has a background with political consulting, where he spent 15 years working in a variety of settings, also doing some speech writing. And Chris is also our resident worldview guy, works alongside Del Tackett, you may be familiar with from the Truth Project. And we love Chris's mind as well as his heart for people who are trying to be engaged in the world around them, to use the passions and gifts God's given them, but also to be strategic and wise based on how political systems work. And he's seen a lot of that from the back end. So we wanted to talk to Chris about moving forward. What does it look like when you've had an election and it looks like all the checks and balances you're used to are gone away? It looks like maybe the opposite party, the people who have all the beliefs opposite from yours, are going to have unchecked government. What is the place? How does a Christian begin to process all that and then try to figure out where they jump into it? So let's just throw that big question out to you, Chris.
Well, it's interesting, and thanks, Steve, for having me on. I think we throw our hands up at the end of an election like this and say, "Oh my goodness, you know, there's nothing we can do." And the assumption is that the other side has taken over completely. And the reality is, there are still a lot of people who fall into more moderate categories, who happen to be on one ticket or another, and it's not nearly as clean as the numbers on a, you know, news election board seem to look.
Right.
It's big and bold in Times Square for ABC News, but the reality is those people that are connected to those numbers in Congress and the Senate and in the White House, they've still got to work through the whole reality of the process of day-to-day governance, and that's messy. It's not nearly as clean or as clean as they'd like it. In terms of getting their legislation through. So I think the first thing the Christian community obviously has to do, and we're called to in Scripture, to hit our knees and to really pray for the wisdom of the leadership of the state. You know, given to Caesar what is due Caesar, Jesus says, but there's an importance to that, not a dismissal. So to be engaged. Second thing is, I think you continue to fight. as the public. This is a government of, for, and by the people.
That's good.
And you continue to fight for the issues that you think are important, and you figure out the venues that are the most effective. And for young people, a lot of it's very much online. I mean, the Facebook discussions during this whole election have been mind-boggling to me. The number of people who have just really engaged, and the groups that popped up, and the advocacy that occurred, all of that was wonderful.
Yeah.
Keep doing it. Keep being involved in that discussion and be a part of the cultural discussion. That's the worst thing Christians could do, is to step away from the table at this point.
That's a good point.
And the third thing, I think, is I want to really encourage, I mean, this is usually sort of a spark for some young person or somebody out there who has been feeling called to public service, but they just didn't know, they don't know how to do it. And now they have an option. There's an, wow, I really want to do something about it. This is the thing that sort of pushes them over the edge and allows them to really think, you know, maybe I can be a part of this, and maybe I can make it better. And you've got either a 2-year cycle or a 4-year cycle to start thinking about that and what it might look like. And it's been encouraging from the Institute to see a couple of our former students who have unsuccessfully run, but they've run. Mm-hmm. And they've run close campaigns in very hard-to-run places for a more conservative young person. And so it's been kind of encouraging. And then to hear them, you know, they're bummed out for a couple of days, but in the end, they're like, you know what? I'm still supposed to do this, and I'm still supposed to be a part of this engagement. So get me in the process.
Here's, let me ask you about something that shows up in a book by Tony Perkins and Bishop Harry Jackson. They talk about how the obituary for conservative Christians has been written numerous times.
Oh, yeah.
And always premature.
Right.
What kind of obituary are you anticipating being written, and how should someone hear that, who, especially coming from someone who's seen the cycles of the political
Somebody made culture. A comment about that book once that that actually was none of it was original. It all came from Augustine. I thought, well, it has been historical then, hasn't it? So, I mean, a lot of these ideas. And they're right, over and over. And we don't do this just for the conservative, you know, part of the of governance, but also the liberal side as well. I mean, we write off the other side once we have a domination on Capitol Hill and in the White House or the State House or wherever it happens to be. And the reality is, the message should be, you know, down but not out, which is, that's the reality of the bounce back. People are always engaged in, you know, let's fight for moral issues, and so, and all moral issues lead to policy issues, and the policy issues and the legislation are all of what's going to happen, and to continue to be informed, and to not, I mean, this is a great time to rest right after the election and sort of gather your troops a bit and be ready to truly engage. That's and there are strategists who are already doing that. They've been doing it for weeks. And, you know, what if X happens? Then we're going to have to start doing Y and Z.
Yeah.
And if something else happens, what are the strategies? And I admire people who have those minds, because they're conceptual in ways that none of us even think of.
Oh, that's good. How about, too, for the person who thinks, you know, back in 2004, it just seemed like Christian conservatives were just at the top of their game, and it was popular and comfortable to be a Christian. You're getting attention like you never did before, and you felt like you've got all your representatives are aware and responsive to your needs, and now you start thinking, well, maybe it's just not cool to be a Christian anymore. Maybe it's not cool to be conservative anymore. Maybe I'm the only person in my circle of friends who still seems to care about life issues or other conservative Christian things. What do you tell them about moving forward when maybe their issues really just aren't cool anymore?
Right. Hey, that's a good reality check, actually, what you just brought up, because, you know, in 2004, we thought we had it made because, you know, the plate was set for us, or the table was set for us, and we should be able to get all of this done.
Right.
Well, in reality, some of it got done, but not a lot of it got done.
That's a good point.
I think we may very well see the same kind of thing going on. And that gives us sort of the reality of governance. And so I have actually quite a bit of hope in terms of watching the system work. I mean, we've got some conservative radio hosts who now have lots of fodder for the next at least 4 years to talk through. So I think then they'll sort of lead the charge in some ways in the media to engage. A lot of young people, I think, in this election, and I saw this through a lot of engagement with our college students who are both here and alumni who are scattered throughout the world, that they were very upset about the lack of interest in social justice issues. Mm-hmm. They care very much about starving people around the world. They care right. very much about the orphan population. They care very much about, you know, clean water supplies and the environment. Right. And when you hear those over and over again, I think there is, I don't understand why they might think it's uncool because they've been marginalized to say, well, yeah, but you only care about like abortion or you only right. care about, you know, those other conservative issues. And the reality is, you know, we care about all of them, and all of those issues we're called to. And I answered an email from a former student the other day who said, "You know, I'm voting this way because this person deals with all the important issues that Christians should care about, and we shouldn't care." And so I said, "The assumption is we shouldn't care about the other ones,
right?
And why is it one or the other?"
Well, and Chris, that also brings up a question about spheres. And I know at right. the Institute there's this big emphasis on understanding that. Even though so often every night on the media you hear this sense of here's the problem and here's the solution that the state can bring.
Right.
But that in reality, we are supposed to have life that is governed in different spheres and that the church has a role to play in the family. And so, for instance, on some of those social justice issues, could it be possible that some people are getting passionate about it, but maybe sometimes misplacing a sense of
exactly.
which sphere should be taking the lead on it and
yeah.
which sphere can appropriately do effective things.
Should do it. Right. I mean, I think one of the things that's really a shame on us to the church is a lot of those social justice issues were ones that we're called to take care of.
Absolutely.
Not to hand over to the state. And in fact, the state messes it up usually.
Right.
I mean, that's how God's design works. When that sphere of influence, whether it's family or work or the church or education or the state, whatever it might be, when it takes on the things that God's design didn't ordain,
right.
we mess it up.
Well, and you know, I think we forget too that bureaucrats aren't known for their hearts.
No.
And that, you know, really the church has an opportunity to deliver compassion in so many of the social justice issues with the heart that needs to come with it.
Right, exactly.
The governments tend to be good about things like collecting taxes and waging wars and things that really don't necessarily require a heart
right.
as much. And, you know, I know there's a whole debate on that. But that whole sphere issue, I'd love to hear more from you in terms of where we can be making investments within our spheres of influence that do provide, I think I've heard you use the term equilibrium,
mm-hmm.
to balance out an encroaching state that's trying to take over areas it shouldn't be in.
Yeah, you seem to give that visual of you know, there's going to be one of those spheres in the middle, and actually in God's design, the family is the first thing he creates, and it goes in the middle, and there's relationships then amongst all the others. Well, the state really is sort of the has overtaken that middle ground and has begun to influence all the others and marginalize work and the economic structures, the education program, except that I would say that that's equally as getting as big, mm-hmm. because that's the mechanism what the state uses to continue to foster those ideas. But the family and the church get marginalized. This is not different. Alvin Schmidt wrote a book on, you know, how Christianity saved the world, and that's actually yeah. a new title because it didn't used to be that direct. Mm-hmm. But the reality was when people were talking to him, they're like, we didn't know that Christians are the ones that started the orphan programs and orphanages. Mm-hmm. We didn't realize they're drawing kids out of the water in Rome that are being thrown over. We didn't understand that Christians had this responsibility from the very beginning, and they knew it intuitively.
That's good.
And I think we do as well. And it's sort of like, I'll tell you what, the place we have the most influence is probably in our family.
Yeah.
Second to that is probably our church. Mm-hmm. And when we have that influence in the church, I think the church needs to very much consider its honest role. What are we mm-hmm. supposed to be doing? And we can't do it all. You know, my little church can't do it all.
Right.
But what piece of the puzzle are we supposed to play? Because God has a plan for the body.
And isn't it true, too, that government is often lagging behind the culture in terms of, yeah, sometimes they overstep and rush into legislation before the culture is ready for it. But a lot of times, it wouldn't be legislation if it wasn't bubbling up in the culture.
Right.
And isn't a big part of that culture family and church.
Right. And those issues, all of them impact those spheres. And most of the ideas come from those spheres. So there's some sort of problem. Oh, well, we must have to, you know, pass some law about it. Mm-hmm. And then we're going to pass this law. And then it's going to have a direct impact back on those spheres, right, wrong, or indifferent.
Right.
And we don't really ever analyze whether that was good or bad, or we just
good.
Did it. And so it's interesting. Because I think, I mean, Francis Schaeffer actually addresses, I take his analogy and go a little further, because he says these new ideas, these ways of governing actually start in the areas of philosophy, and they work through the arts, mm-hmm. and then they work into the church, and then they work into the state. And so if you think about that, the way I change it is it's almost like a roller coaster that, you know, philosophy and all these new ideas and the moral ethical foundations, they've gone over the hill.
That's good.
And government's, you know, back here at the top, and the other ones are already changing to something new, but they're behind the times a bit.
That's a good point. Well, just to wrap up, I know you talked about prayer for those in authority and those in leadership. Could you just mention a little bit about some specific ways we can be praying for those in authority and leadership that we may disagree with, but also maybe even beginning to pray for those people who might be stepping up in future elections, future generations, who are probably going to be doing it in a certain wilderness environment, and also, as we found out from this last election, are going to get thrown to the lions, in a sense, by the media scrutiny and all the other headaches of actually trying to be a public servant.
Yeah, you have to be ready for the process, because the election and campaigning process really is very distracting to candidates, because it's they know the issues. They got into it for a reason, but their family and their reputations and everything about them becomes fair game. And unfortunately, it goes over the top usually.
Right.
I mean, it goes over the top very quickly. And in a media saturated
and
culture,
on both sides, right?
Exactly. It's not a one sided issue. It's very bipartisan, because everybody gets it. And we look for the dirt, and we like in some ways to see the dirt come out about, ooh, there's something nasty about that person, and I've been looking for something nasty to not want to believe in them or their ideas. And so it takes I think a strong family unit to step up into that and to be willing to face that. And interestingly enough, our new president woke up this morning and I think began to think more seriously, not about campaigning, but about governing.
Yeah.
And that's a very different role. And I really do feel like, and I've watched candidates do this when they're elected, I believe he'll walk into the Oval Office on January 21st and feel the weight, not just the agenda, not just the campaigning and not the campaign promises, but the weight of governing the United States and what it stands for in the world.
That's heavy.
And my prayer then is for wise people around them.
Yeah.
In the kings, we asked for the kings in the Old Testament, and God was like, "You sure about that?" And we're like, "Yeah, we really want them." And they're like, "Great, okay, here you got them." And we got some really great ones, and we got some really bad ones. And the common theme amongst all of them was whether they were willing to seek out wise counsel or not. And so I really pray for wise counsel. There's no way that any single candidate knows everything about every single issue.
Right.
And so you got to put some people around you in the White House and even beyond that will not only help you in terms of information, but they're willing to talk to you personally, accountably, and that you're open to that kind of, that's one of the things, accountability and leadership. It doesn't matter whether you're in a church or the United States president, you've still got to have that sort of personal accountability. You're not on your own.
That's good. Well, Chris, thank you so much. Just as a closing thought, what's your last word of encouragement for someone who's new to the process, maybe just experienced their first national election, got to vote in their first one, and is trying to stay hopeful about what's still ahead of them?
Elections they impact the culture, no doubt, but they're not do or die. And it's not all over. The encouragement is we still have a wonderful system. That's the cool thing about this American experiment, is that we still get to engage. This is now has not become a dictatorship.
Right.
And we still get to engage in the democratic process. And there are lots of ways for us to do that. And to pick up the phone and talk to those new representatives. Man, when they come to town halls, because candidates are always, very available. And then they get into office and we rarely see them. But there are a lot of them that are very accessible. Your local government officials. Take advantage of it. Get to know them. Find out where they're coming from. And I believe you can have more influence than you think sitting across a cup of coffee, with a state senator than you think you can.
That's powerful. Well, Chris, thank you so much. And
That's
we'll look
pleasure.
Forward to maybe even having you in again as we have more developments and can talk about more ways people can get plugged in.
Sure.
Thanks again.
Thank you.
On Christ, the Son of God, we stand, who came to earth as God in man. You rescued us from death. Now we are alive in Him. Jesus, my glory, Holy One, Divine.
Opening up this week's Boundless Inbox, I have Candace in the studio with me. Welcome, Candace.
Hi, Lisa.
Hello. This is going to be a fascinating question because it is from a listener who is asking how to go about maintaining a relationship with her parents while she's away or having been in college and then looking even ahead into the future, you know, when she has a family of her own. So let's take a listen and see what she has to say. I am a recent college grad who's trying to make the transition into a career. I went to college close enough to home that I visited my folks every other weekend. I'm very close to my parents, but do not want to start my career in our area. Most of the jobs I've applied for are on the other side of the country. How can I maintain a close relationship with my parents if I move states away? And when I start a family, how can my parents be a real part of my children's life? Do I have to choose between a strong relationship with my parents and relocating for work?
Well, this is a question that I have wrestled with because we did move states away from my parents and from Steve's parents when we got married. And I think you can be encouraged that, no, you don't have to give up your strong relationship with your parents. What you're going to have to give up, though, is the physical contact with your parents. You're not going to be able to see them as often and feel their hugs and hear their voices, you know, across the table. You're going to have to settle for phone calls and email and Skype, which is great because you can talk and see them at the same time. Although sometimes that makes it harder because it's like, oh, you're so close and I can't quite touch you through that computer screen. I think you're really asking two questions. One is, do I have to give up the closeness of the relationship? And the answer is no. The other question is, though, do I have to choose between being physically close and having a career that doesn't, you know, lend itself easily to the community where my parents currently live? And the answer to that is probably going to be yes, if you decide to pursue that career. And so I would just encourage you to pray that God would open the doors he wants you to walk through. And sometimes he does call us to professions and jobs that are far enough away that, you know, we only get to see our folks maybe once or twice a year, depending on what your income is and how many plane tickets you can afford to buy.
I think I'll add, too, speaking as a singleton for whom my immediate family, my birth family, is still my family. You know, I haven't started a family of my own. And I think there have been times in my life where it's been especially hard not having that close contact. But what I have really tried to do is become a solid part of my church family. And that has become a great support for me in really seeking out that connection and that accountability and really finding a home there. And that's a great substitute in some senses. I would also say that in any kind of relationship, whether you live a mile away or 1,000 miles away, intentionality is key. I mean, you can live next door to your parents and not have a good relationship
with
them.
That's true.
So to really be intentional, I know with my mom, especially since having lost my dad, it's so meaningful for her to have me call and have me just connect. And I still get, you know, great benefit from my relationship with her, and we have a good relationship. But we work at it. You know, we do keep each other up on what's going on in our lives, and we pray for one another and stuff. So I think, you know, that just might be valuable, too, to keep in mind that, you know, really making an effort to have a real relationship, whether it's across the miles or whether it's in person, is a good thing as well.
Well, and I think that's really good advice that if you're not having a close physical connection with your mom and dad, meaning you're not getting a hug a day, you're not getting, you know, the ability to go for walks and actually, you know, smell what they had for lunch coming off their sweater. I mean, you need the physicality of relationship. And that's where I think plugging into a church and maybe even sort of adopting a family with little kids. When I was single, I lived with a family with kids, and it meant so much at the end of the workday to come home and have these little kids to tickle and hug and run around with and just be in their lives and be in their physical space, because you need that human connection. But that will never take the place of a good, solid relationship with your parents. And so don't worry that if you start pouring love into another family that you're somehow going to, you know, shortchange your own biological parents, because you can still maintain a really solid relationship with them through the phone and through the computer and other ways.
Right. That is correct. So, well, hopefully our answers, our weighing in on this have been helpful to you. As always, we want your feedback. Write to us, editor@boundless.org, or give us a call, 1-866-687-8686, and give us your feedback and questions for future shows as well. I think that one is an especially appropriate one now as we head into Thanksgiving and Christmas, and recognizing that family is important and we want to maintain those connections. And how do we go about doing that? So that said, we will plan on seeing you around next week for the Inbox, as well as a completely different show where we will talk about issues and topics relevant to today's young adults in their 20s and 30s, many of whom are single, some of whom are married. Candace, it's not a relationship question this week. Oh my goodness.
I know. Keep them coming.
I know.
We like to mix it up a little bit.
We are mixing it up. So that is it for this week's show. I'm your host, Lisa Anderson. We look forward to seeing you around next week. Have a great week as we head into the colder weather. And we appreciate you being a part of our Boundless family.
The Boundless Show is a production of Boundless.org. Focus on the family.